Is it time for a mind shift? If you don't know what that means, then join your host, Dr. Clint Haycock, a former evangelical Christian pastor and Bible college teacher of over 20 years, along the journey of deconstruction and reconstruction of faith, life, religion, and spirituality.
I am so happy to welcome back a returning guest all the way from Montreal in Canada. Thank you, Dr. Andre Gagné, for being not only a returning guest, but actually the inaugural guest, first episode of Mindshift Podcast for 2020. So welcome, Andre, to the show again.
Yeah, oh, thank you so much for your kind invitation, and what an honor, eh, to be the kickoff.
You're the kickoff.
For this new decade, when we think about it.
Absolutely.
So that's great. Thank you very much for your invitation.
Yes, I'm glad to have you back because we have so much to talk about. We were talking a little bit before we hit record about what we want to cover in this episode. There are some absolutely fascinating things. Some things have changed since we talked just a few months ago. One of the things is I've been doing a huge amount of research. As I was saying to you earlier, I've written about, it's up to about 150 pages now of compiling the teachings of Dominion Theology, Seven Mountains Dominion Theology, Christian Reconstructionism. We're going to unpack all that, I'm sure. But what is interesting is, trying to get your head around all this stuff, it's very confusing. There's a lot of streams. There's a lot of things going on in there. But what's coming up, I was going to say, before we start talking, the next episode of Mindshift Podcast, this is another really interesting guest that I booked on the show, Andrew Seidel, who's the Freedom From Religion Foundation.
Yes.
He's written a book on Christian nationalism, which obviously has correlations to what we're going to be talking about. Yeah. So that's coming up in the next episode of Mindshift Podcast. I'm super excited to be talking to Andrew Seidel about his new book and specifically on this issue of not just Christian nationalism, but of course the evangelical support for Donald Trump and the dominionist sort of angle to the whole thing, which we'll, I'm sure, get into. So, yeah, I don't know where you're coming from anymore, but my head's about to explode as I read this stuff. I've been listening to a podcast, actually. I'll say this, that Johnny Enlow, who's a major Seven Mountains Dominionist guy, he's got a podcast. I think it's called Restore Seven.
Yes.
The name of the podcast, if people want to look him up. And he goes through the Seven Mountains mandate. And I've been listening to that on the way to work, and it's doing my head in. So I need to talk to someone who can understand where I'm coming from. So thanks for dropping in.
And you know that Enlow actually wrote at least three books on that. Mm. On the Seven Mountains. So,
I've been reading his books as well.
Really, really working this. He's one of the major players. And it's interesting that we often hear about Lance Wallnau. That's like the kind of, I call him the Seven Mountains Mandate Guru. Mm-hmm. He's the top guy that we always hear about most of the time, especially in how that's been developed and how he picked that up from Bill Bright and Lauren Cunningham. Mm-hmm. But Enlow has been major player also, seems to be a bit less well known, but he's done extensive promotion of this idea, and it's important. And you said something, I'm happy that you're compiling all this stuff. I think it's very important, and you might end up writing a book out of this.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes very complicated to follow all these streams as you're uncovering.
Yeah, more aware of that.
As you're seeing, because it's going into all sorts of different directions. You have different types of people that have different eschatologies also. They're not all post-millennialists. Like, we have a tendency of associating dominionism to naturally post-millennialists, but they're not all that. There's been a change since the advent of charismatics in the movement, where you have premillennial dispensationalists that also embrace dominionist ideas. There's that. There's also, you know, there's charismatics, there's less charismatic people. What do you do with Christian Reconstructionists? That's another brand also. That's another, you know, that's another issue in and of itself, because they have a different philosophical base on the idea of what it means when we think in terms of dominionism. It's not the Seven Mountains Mandate. This is very, very different. And actually, you know, people that belong to the Christian Reconstructionist movement have been quite critical for some of them of the Seven Mountains Mandate approach, because they feel that this is not reflective of how they envision dominionism. It's not the same. So the challenge is to untangle all of that, especially for the general public, because a lot of people, they're not theologians, or they're not biblical scholars or things like that, and they casually hear about this on Twitter. We both are on Twitter, and we post stuff on that. But we have a lot of people that are still kind of wondering, what is this all about? Where is this going? How can we really have a handle on these complex issues? And I think a podcast like yours is important to try to untangle these things.
It is important. And I was saying before we hit record, there's been three events that have happened since you and I talked a few months ago. The first of which is the Christianity Today article that came out on December 22nd, 2019, written by Mark Galley. I think he's an executive editor there. Yeah. And he called for Trump's removal from office, impeachment and removal, from a specifically evangelical point of view. Now, that in and of itself caused a firestorm, because he's really, I think, the first real high-profile Christian evangelical to stand and take a stand against what he sees against going on in the Trump administration. Now, what I found fascinating is on the 29th of December, there was an open letter response signed by over 200 evangelical leaders to Christianity Today, dismissing their argument and saying, hey, you know, we're not, you're calling us out. Now, what I found fascinating was, as I went down the list of those signatories of that open letter response, immediately several names jumped out. Known dominionists, Lance Wallnau, Cindy Jacobson. Cindy Jacobs, yeah, from Generals International, and a bunch of pastors. What I started doing was I started going through and researching who the people were that I didn't know who they were, and I found many, many links to dominionist pastors, people that were part of major organizations that were part of dominion theology. Then on the 3rd of January, there was a Trump rally at a major church, King Jesus International Church in Miami, pastored by a Pastor Maldonado, a Latino Hispanic church. Yeah. Now, he's another known dominionist, and I think he's also a signer of that open letter.
Yeah, he is. Yeah.
Then there was, of course, the Trump assassination of Soleimani in Iraq. And the interesting thing was the response, mainly by some of these major dominionist players, turning it into like a prophetic spiritual warfare thing. Yeah. So I think to answer the question, why should people be concerned? These are the people that are on Trump's evangelical advisory board. They're holding rallies at their churches for Donald Trump. Yeah. They have Trump's ear, and they're helping him make decisions on policy level from a dominionist point of view. That should be of concern to everyone. I don't care who you are.
Absolutely, you're spot on, and you know, the call by Christianity Today has made waves, yes, but they do not have the biggest share of the Christian market. We know that magazines like Charisma, which is more charismatically leaning and it's more sympathetic to the charismatic dominionist perspective, has much more an impact from a global perspective. So, you know, these people, these signatories that reacted to Christianity Today, they said, you know, you really don't represent that many Christians. We have much more Christians that we're influencing. Yeah.
We have a bigger base.
You're actually despising a large swath of the evangelical population by condemning the mm-hmm. vote that they chose in favor of Trump. So you're condemning a big portion of the evangelicals in America. Mm-hmm. So that's what you see. Eh? You have, of course, the evangelicals that are more kind of progressive evangelicals that you have from Christianity Today. And then you have that other charismatically leaning type of evangelicals represented by Charisma and others that have signed that letter of protest. And in the midst of that, you have that rally, very clear rally that was sponsored by this apostle. And it's interesting because you had all sorts of evangelicals show up at that rally. There were more kind of conservative type of evangelicals that had voted for Trump, but they were more shy. This was a very lively Pentecostal of church, you know,
absolutely.
So they didn't know too much how to kind of behave.
Yeah, much more conservative.
That's it, in that church. And it was funny because after that rally, Lance Wallnau did a short clip at the airport. He was with his wife, and he was talking about the rally. So he came out of the rally and he said, you know, these rallies, the, you know, some of the Pentecostals were on their best, some of the evangelicals there were on their best behavior, but right. Rallies should be in Pentecostal churches. Trump rallies should be in Pentecostal churches because they're more reflective of the enthusiasm and the dynamism that Trump rallies should be about. So he was there. He was very much open, but at the same time, one of the things he said in that video, and it struck me, he said that this coalition that has been established among evangelicals, this coalition for Trump, evangelicals for Trump, he wants to work in 2020 for a larger coalition of believers, not only of evangelicals, but of believers. That means Jewish believers, that means Roman Catholics if needed, but he wants to broaden this coalition, and this, of course, is all part of the religion mountain. Eh? We know in the Seven Mountains Mandate, one of the mountains is religion. Mm-hmm. Huh? So by broadening this coalition, going to get more Christian actors from various segments of Christianity, then they can assure a re-election for Trump. You see? So
absolutely.
It's very, very interesting how things are unfolding.
It's coming
and
together.
How, you know, how the dominionists, at least the charismatically leaning dominionists, are really, really behind Trump and mobilizing and doing everything they can to influence the vote and making sure that he's reelected in 2020.
Well, absolutely. You mentioned Charisma Magazine. I was listening to an episode of Stand in the Gap radio podcast, which has a lot of dominionists on the show.
Yeah.
They had Michelle Bachman on there not long ago, who's a known dominionist.
Yeah.
And they had Stephen Strang, who's the founder of Charisma Magazine, Charisma Media. And they were asking him about the importance of the 2020 Trump vote. And Stephen Strang said, for evangelicals in 2020, it is literally all or nothing. Everything is on the line in 2020 for us. If Trump doesn't get reelected, we lose everything.
Yeah.
It's all or nothing. It's everything. And I thought, wow, that says it all right there. Yeah. I mean, this is Stephen Strang, like you say, from Charisma Magazine, a known dominionist kind of rag. They have all kinds of articles from C. Peter Wagner, who was the
main
founder of you know, the new apostolic reformation, a major dominionist himself, and on it goes. And you think, whoa, is that's where they're coming from? And as you say, I think I saw a blurb on reading about one of these conservative but not sort of charismatic people at that Trump rally in Miami. Yeah. And some reporter asked him, because you had people like Tony Perkins from the Family Research Council. This is part of Dr. James Dobson's focus on the family. What are they doing at a charismatic church, A, and then B,
That's
not really dominionists like a Lance Wallnau or someone like that. And this person said, well, we can set aside our theological differences because we're working toward the same ends, which is, of course, the support for Trump and all the rest of it. Yeah. So, yeah, like you said, they're building a coalition. These people shouldn't theologically be in the same church building because they fundamentally disagree on the spiritual gifts and everything else, but they're there.
Yeah, that's what is part of the Christian right. Eh? The Christian right has managed to mobilize all of these different groups, evangelical groups from different types of backgrounds, and given them a sense of purpose and direction, and inciting them to get involved politically. And it seems to be working. They're really rallied, and they want Trump to vote. And like you said, I think Strang expressed it very well. It's all or nothing. If Trump doesn't win, they really characterize this in dramatic terms. Eh? It's really like it's going to be a catastrophe. We're going to lose everything if Trump loses. So
what's going to happen?
All or nothing.
Or if he gets impeached and removed from office.
Yeah, exactly.
Is, again, I do listen to a lot of the Stand in the Gap podcast episodes because, like with Johnny Enlow, it's very revealing to hear where they're coming from and their sort of talking points. And a lot of them are about the Trump impeachment, and they call it, the sham impeachment. And the witch. They're just repeating the sort of Trump talking points. It's a witch hunt. It's a sham. It's, blah, blah, blah. And I think, okay, so they're going right down that line, repeating his talking points. Well, now I'm thinking, if someone didn't catch our first episode, maybe we're getting ahead of the game here because we've been talking about Christian Reconstruction, Dominion Theology, what are you talking about, Andre? My head's already going to explode. Can you give us a sort of an overview, a thumbnail sketch of what actually are we talking about when we say Dominion Theology? What is that? What does it mean? What's it all about?
Yeah, the thing is, I think Fred Clarkson has one of the best definitions of that. It's about dominionism is really about Christians ruling in God's name and affecting the various spheres of society and culture, and that despite the theology or the timeline. They don't, the dominionism has managed as an ideology to help people discard their theology, their particularities in eschatology, and even, I would say, even in their soteriology, to put that aside and just focus on the idea that Christians are called by God to rule the world and change society by penetrating its spheres of culture. So that's essentially what it is, dominionism. And it's based, of course, on a particular interpretation, as we know, of Genesis chapter 1, verses 26 and 27, about God calling humankind to rule the earth and subdue it. So it's applied, of course, to humankind, but for dominionists, it's all about Christians ruling the world. Now, when we think in terms of the brands of dominionism, there's brands, there's various manifestations.
Streams.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, there's a lot of different ways to say it.
Yeah, of talking about that. And one of the most early forms of that and what where we started talking about dominionism and even using that term specifically as a technical term was with the rise of Christian Reconstructionism in the 60s with Roussas Roujdouni, who is a Presbyterian minister of Calvinistic theological thought. And for him, it was all about the importance of God's law as becoming the rule or the law of society, that society should be be fashioned according to the laws of God.
Mm-hmm.
And he talked in terms, of course, he borrowed some of his ideas from Albert Kuyper, who was a Calvinist at the beginning of the 20th century. He was actually the prime minister of the Netherlands. Mm-hmm. And Kuyper had a kind of a Calvinistic theology that focused on what is called sphere sovereignty, where Christ should rule or God should rule in every sphere of our lives. As Christians, we should submit every spheres of our lives to Christ. So that means personally, my family, my community, everything should come under Christ's sovereignty. But we need to remember these people are still Calvinists. So they believe in the sovereignty of God. They believe that even for someone to be saved, people cannot be saved by their own works or by their own will or by their own faith, but God has to regenerate them. As Calvinists, they believe in determinism, they believe in election, and they believe that God actually chooses certain individuals to be saved over others. So it's what is called monergism. Yeah, monergism. I always had a hard time with it. Thank you. I always had a hard time with that term.
It's not a word you use every day, is it?
No, it's not. Yeah, I don't talk with that.
Impress your friends.
Yeah, monergism.
That's what I learned today, monergism. No one will know what you're talking about. I guarantee it.
It's about letting God do the work, letting God establish his own kingdom. God is the one that works sovereignly. And of course, Kuyper had that perspective. Rushduni also had that perspective. So when we talk in terms of even dominionism, even Christian reconstructionism, all of these ideas, they still rely very much on God's sovereignty. So for Rushduni, for example, which is totally different than from the Seven Mountains Mandate, change or social transformation comes from a grassroots movement and affects the higher echelons eventually of society. And it's mainly done for Rushduni through Christian education. So if people teach their children Christian values, they will in their lives live out those values, and the progression of Christian thought will permeate society progressively. This is not an aggressive movement. This is a progressive grassroots thing. Now, when you talk in terms of Seven Mountains Mandate, this is completely different, because Seven Mountains Mandate is basically promoted by people that are more, they're less Calvinistic in their thinking. They're more Arminian. That means that they believe that they have to actively believe in God to be saved. They have to work for their salvation. They have to make sure that they preserve their salvation. So they believe in more of a kind of a cooperation with God, where human beings have to do things. It doesn't rely on God. It relies on human beings that take God's laws seriously. And so it's much more of a human effort. So this is why people Bill Bright and Lauren Cunningham and people like Walnau, they talk about conquering those mountains. You see, so it's a top-down thing. And they're not into massive conversions. It's more about influencing generally the top of the mountain to change the culture. And discipling nations is just that. It's not converting nations, but it's discipling them, bringing them under the influence of the gospel. Whereas Rushduni and company and Christian Reconstructionists would not agree with that. You see, they would disagree with that. They would say, no, people need to experience individually personal revival that will change them and their comportment and their way of being will then affect society progressively. You see, so we have two types of dominionism, one that's brought about by the instigation and the activation of Christians, you know, that get involved and they do the change and they bring about the change, and Christian Reconstructionism, which is all for the same change, is all about, of course, bringing in the kingdom of God and all of that. It's all about
use the same language.
It's all about that, theonomy and all of that, but relying on God's own timing and sovereignty to do that. So we're in two different dynamics. It's still dominionism, but two different types of dynamics. And this is why sometimes Christian Reconstructionists don't recognize themselves in New Apostolic Reformation stuff, because they say that this is not what we're talking about. You see, and we're not talking about taking politics by force. At least their understanding of politics. You see, they don't, like, for us, politics is the entirety of life. It's everyday policies, it's everything. For them, politics is only civil government. It's different. They have a different definition of what constitutes politics. So they're going to play on words with that, you see? And as you know this very well, and I think you've studied eschatology very well in the past also, Christian Reconstructionists, for the most part, are postmillennialists. So they don't talk in terms of dispensational theology, premillennial rapture.
Yeah, rapture.
They don't have that. They're going to...
Thousand-year kingdom.
That's it. They're going to go slowly bringing in the kingdom of God through their personal witness and through a progressive, slow transformation of society. Whereas in New Apostolic Reformation, you're going to have all sorts of people. You're going to have postmillennialists. You're going to have premillennialists that will adopt the dominionist mandate. You're going to have rapture people. You're still going to have dispensationalists. You're going to have, it's going to be a complete melting pot, you see? And this is why now we can say that dominionism is not only postmillennial anymore. It's postmillennial, it's premillennial, it's amillennial. They have everybody. Anybody that believes that Christians should rule, have the mandate to rule by God and to change society and bring about the kingdom of God and through God's rule, that's essentially dominionism.
Yeah, it's very hard to get your head around it, as you said, because what I've been doing is I've been going through and compiling sort of a systematic theology, if you will, of specifically Seven Mountains dominion theology, just trying to get my head around how they actually move from sort of point to point to point. They agree, as you say, on, they start from the Genesis 1, 26, 28. Adam and Eve were given dominion by God, et cetera, et cetera. When they sinned, they lost that dominion, and then Satan usurped it. So now he is now the God of this world. So the goal of Christians from that point on is to kick Satan off the world, and he inhabits those seven mountains. And this becomes, it's not only just about occupying the mountains. In order to occupy the mountains, you've got to first displace the demonic forces that currently sit atop those mountains. We're talking mountains, like you say, government, art and entertainment, media, education, religion. Those are some of the seven mountains or cultural spheres of influence. They're saying a demonic territorial spirit is sitting over those mountains. We've got to tear down the strongholds and kick them off the mountain and then occupy it. So there's a whole language and a theology going on there that's incredibly complex, as I'm finding out.
And you see, and you very well laid it out, it starts for everybody, for Christian Reconstructionists and Seven Mountain Mandate people, it starts with Genesis 1. Mm-hmm. But then it kind of declines itself in different ways, and you have the Seven Mountains Mandate. And as you see, and as you said very, very clearly, they have to displace these supernatural entities over mountains or over cultural spheres or territories or whatever. But that's done through their agency. You see, their own agency.
Their
own involvement in prayer walks, in binding spirits and fasting and engaging in spiritual warfare. It's not about God's sovereignty. You see, it's not about God doing this. It's their agency doing it. It's they will do it. So this is a completely different conceptualization, theologically speaking, about the sovereignty of God, which is, as we know, for Calvinists, this is sacred. The sovereignty, it's all about the sovereignty of God. God decides everything, and everything that happens in the world stems from his sovereignty. Now, you said something interesting also about the mountains. As you know, this you know, well now heard about what Bill Bright and Lauren Cunningham said in 1975. They supposedly had the same, you know, vision or whatever. And when they got together, it was the same thing.
Yeah, they both said, we've had this revelation about the Seven Mountains mandate.
Yeah,
that's the official story. Yeah, I've read it on several websites.
Yeah, that's it.
This is where it came from. It was prophetic revelation independently arrived at by these two great men of God.
Yeah. And Walnau picks it up. Walnau picks it up. But, you know, there's an interesting thing about that. It's that this happened in 1975. And they were both in California. And at that time, what's interesting is that 2 years prior to that, Rushduni had already written his opus on Christian Reconstructionism.
The Institutes of Biblical Law.
And all of that in 73. And he had been talking about that at least 5 years prior to that. So it's almost impossible that they didn't hear about that.
Of course,
they're coming up with this idea that, you know, we both independently had this revelation. But come on, let's be serious. They were both in the same area. They were all in California. Rushduni was doing his circuit of teaching around these questions.
Yeah, they're in the same region, same area.
Everything is impossible.
Too many things are lining up.
No. The only thing they did is they systematized that. They, instead of talking about spheres and things like that, Rushduni did not have mountains and things like that. They came up with the mountain metaphor, and it went on from there. You see, it went on from there, and charismatics join in the picture, and you have people like C. Peter Wagner that joined in, and they kind of gave Dominionism a new flavor. And, you know, where they emphasize less on the idea that, you know, if society or if someone, because Rushduni was saying that, you know, you have to apply biblical law to society, and that means Old Testament laws. And if people sin, there are Old Testament consequences to people's sin. And if people have to die by capital punishment because of adultery or stealing, they have to die. Even if Rushduni admitted that he didn't like that. But he said, I have to submit myself to the law of God.
Got to follow the law.
He embraced a covenantal theology. For him, it was everything. Like the Old Testament had, or the Hebrew Bible had the same weight as the New Testament. For him, it's one thing. Whereas when you come with people like C. Peter Wagner and others that kind of take over with the Seven Mountains Mandate, they kind of drop to the wayside these ideas that seemed extreme of, you know, bringing about capital punishment for people that would sin and stuff like that. They kind of drop that on the wayside.
It's a little too extreme.
It's too extreme for them, you know? But they will still talk in terms of bringing about the kingdom of God and doing it through the permeation of society and those cultural mountains. So in the end, it's still dominionism, but it's a kind of a different dominionism that has different, a kind of a different philosophical and theological base to it. But it still remains a form of dominionism. Still remains dominionism.
Yeah, and I think it's important to note that for a guy like Rushduni, you're not. I know you're not trying to paint this lovely picture, rainbows and unicorns and everything else, because what I've been reading about is the influence of Rushduni and his organization, which he founded, the Chalcedon Foundation, Gary North, some of these other people that was sort of a disciple of his, who's gone on to do a lot of writing on the Christian right. And what's been really chilling is the vision that Rushduni had for when Christians were in charge of society and when the Old Testament law was in effect. You get a society that is, it's straight out of The Handmaid's Tale. It's Gilead.
Absolutely.
It's unbelievable the type of vision that society would look like. And this is the question, you know, this is something I've come across, is this sort of spectrum, what they call hard and soft dominion theology. You know, you've got the hard dominion theology would be the Reconstructionism, the theonomy, the society patterned upon God's law. The softer is the Seven Mountains side, it's about infiltration and, as you say, this taking over these mountains with Christians in charge of the media and arts and entertainment and education and et cetera, et cetera. But the end result, as you say, the vision is we need to get Christians in charge of this thing.
That's it.
Whenever we find them, they should be in government. They should be in education. They should be, you know, so the strategy, maybe that's the way to say it, for how they get there, it looks different.
That's exactly it. One is from top-down strategy. Mm-hmm, the other one is the bottom-up, which is more Christian Reconstructionist, more long-term, relying on the sovereignty of God, on God's timing. The other one, they're setting the timetable, you see? Yeah. They're going to bring about the kingdom of God, and it's really top-down, that Seven Mountains mandate. And you're right. There were people that really labeled that at one point as like a hard dominionist, soft dominionist. That's one way of kind of conceptualizing or making sense of both of them. But there's so much cross-fertilization between all of these groups. And as you saw, between eschatology and different ideas, even different political theological ideas on how to gain that power, how to actually, you know, make those changes in society. And it's fascinating. I'm going to be doing actually next fall, I'm going to have a graduate course where we're going to read Rishduni stuff. Because I want students to be familiar with that.
Yeah, expose them to this stuff.
I to really kind of learn and tackle those primary sources so that they can understand, okay, where does these ideas that come from the Christian right actually, where do they emerge? Where did they kind of originate? And of course, it starts with Rishduni. And Rishduni had a profound impact on several political leaders in his day. And he had a major impact on the Coalition on Revival, as you know, with Jay Grimstead. Mm-hmm. The Coalition on Revival, they still have a website out. They have those documents, the worldview documents. They have 17 worldview documents. That's
24-year plan.
That's it. That's it, the 24-year plan, all of that. So that's tailored on Rishduni's thinking. Mm-hmm. You see, this is very, very close to Rishduni stuff. And you had people close to Rishduni, like Gary DeMar, for example, that were involved in the crafting of some of those documents.
Mm-hmm.
Because you know what the Coalition on Revival did is they managed for the first time to bring charismatics and non-charismatics together and trying to establish a coalition that would kind of influence politics or kind of mobilize Christians to political action. So it's the first time they do that. The Coalition on Revival manages to do that. That's great. But you have these charismatics on one side, and then you have these sophisticated Calvinistic theologians on the other side that have all the sophistication, theologically speaking, to be able to lay out that plan. You have the charismatics that are very enthusiastic and they can mobilize people, but they don't have the theological language. You see, they don't have the
academic
theology
background. Yeah,
that's it. All of the meat and potatoes that is needed to actually articulate that theology. And at the same time, you have these theologians, like Christian Reconstructionists, that cannot or don't have the resources to mobilize as the charismatics do. You see? So this is why they needed to merge. The Christian Reconstructionists needed the impetus of charismatic groups and other types of evangelicals that were more action-oriented, because they were less action-oriented. You see, they had a strong philosophy, they had a strong theological basis with their Calvinistic thought on what should be done, but they weren't able to mobilize anybody. So they needed the other groups to actually do that. So this is how Rishduni's thinking started permeating evangelicalism.
That's it.
through initiatives like that, through the Coalition on Revival, and through other political actors at the time that would not admit that they had read Rushduni, but they
had.
They knew who he was, but would never admit it. But they actually knew what he was.
As
he
you said.
And they were aware of his political theology.
Yeah, but there's a lot of obfuscation I'm finding. Yes. They don't admit, but what you can do is once you key in on certain phrases and terminology that they all sort of use, you start seeing those. It was kind of like my experience of reading through the list of signatories to the open letter to Christianity Today. Because I'd been doing so much research on these people, I immediately, these names just jumped off the list at me. And I'm like, okay. She's a Dominionist. He's a Dominionist. Absolutely. Yeah. And I thought, what's this list doing here? Why are these people signing this along with people like Tony Perkins and people, you know, on the far right that have nothing to do in seemingly with Dominionist theology and charismatic. But I was doing some research on Michelle Bachmann, you know, and what I found is there were two kind of major influences on her. One is Francis Schaeffer, which you were describing earlier, this idea of a biblical worldview permeating all of life, all of society. That comes out of A Christian Manifesto and his film series.
Yeah,
she was influenced by Francis Schaeffer as a young person. And then she went to Oral Roberts University Law School, where she was influenced by a guy named John Eidsmo, who was a disciple of Rushduni's work. And so this is where you start getting the idea that America should be founded, if not exactly on God's law, then on biblical principles and that kind of thinking. Yeah. And then she takes that on into politics.
Yeah.
This is her background. This is where she comes from. And you start putting the names together, and that's where you find those connections, I think. And you go, okay, so this is a stream, as you said, and you can start connecting the dots.
Yeah.
And that's how these people have such – and she may have never heard of Rushduni, influenced by him nonetheless.
That's exactly that. And that's why it's important for us to familiarize ourselves with the type of language that comes out of these streams, be able to make those distinctions between the types of streams, between the types of eschatologies, soteriologies, pneumatologies, all of this, make those distinctions, but at the same time realize that Dominionism managed to become this umbrella over all of these distinctions, a kind of umbrella that can bring under its shade all of these distinctions. The important thing is for Christians to exercise God's mandate in this world. And you're right. She might have never heard about Rushduni, but was profoundly influenced by Rushduni. You see that list that you mentioned in this response, you had all sorts of people. You had a lot of Dominionists and Dominionists from different shades of eschatological backgrounds. You know, you had postmillennials, but you had premillennials that still believe in dispensationalism. And you see, this is so important, and I can't stress this enough. My next series, YouTube series, is going to be dedicated just to the question of dispensational premillennialism. Mm-hmm. The reason why I'm doing this is because there's a lot of people that think that dispensational premillennialism has disappeared, that people don't believe that anymore. And it's incorrect to think that. It's not because new apostolic reformation people are more prevalent in politics that they're necessarily all post-millennial and that they all don't expect the rapture anymore. No, they're a bunch of Dominionists and new apostolic people, reformation people that still embrace those ideas of the rapture, and there's going to be a physical millennium of a thousand years after that. There's still people that think that there's going to be a great tribulation. There's still people that believe that Gog and Magog in Ezekiel chapters 38 and 39 is a prophecy that talks about Russia and Iran attacking Israel. They still believe that, but they're still Dominionists. They're still, yeah, the end some of the day. Them will embrace new apostolic reformation ideas. So we have to be careful not to pigeonhole people strictly. He's a Dominionist, so he has to believe this. Or she's a Dominionist, she can't believe this. No, there's too much cross-fertilization between
too broad these of a spectrum.
Yeah, it's like it's a melting pot.
It really is.
It's just a melting pot, and we have to kind of clearly identify these streams.
And I think it's critical to, as we were saying before, the key words, the key phrases that tend to pop up. Because, for example, one of the signatories on that open letter, I can't remember her name, but she was part of an organization. It's called Awaken the Dawn. Mm. Now, I'm like, what is that? I've never heard of that. Oh. I started researching it. Awaken the Dawn is a massive nationwide rally that's held. They've held several rallies in the past, and they're planning more in 2020. And as you were saying before, the beautiful thing about the New Apostolic Reformation and certain the Seven Mountains Dominion people, they've been, because of that charismatic, exuberant sort of worship style, they've been able to pull in a huge amount of young sort of millennial audiences.
Yeah.
So what Awaken the Dawn does is they have these huge rallies where they might have 50, 60, 70,000 people packed into an outdoor, area with a massive stage, couple of absolutely rocking popular bands, worship service. It's high energy. It's all the rest of it. And there's prayer and we're praying for the fate of the nation. What could be wrong with that?
Yeah.
We're praying for America. But when I started researching, I find out these people are part of an organization called the Fredericksburg Prayer Furnace, which is in Fredericksburg, Virginia, which is affiliated with IHOP Kansas City, Mike Bickle.
Yeah.
And they hold basically like a 24/7 prayer service in Fredericksburg. And so they actually stream IHOP Kansas City's services when they're not actually in holding their services. And you start tracing this stuff back and you're like, okay, now I can start making those connections. Yeah. Who are these people and where do they come from and what are their affiliations? Yeah. Again, it's you got to do your homework. That's what I'm discovering. It's a lot of work. It's a huge amount of work.
It's a lot of work. It's a full-time job.
It really is. And I don't have time to do it. But I'm finding time. I'm glad to, chat with people like yourself and, having chats on Twitter and things like that, because I hope if people don't get anything else out of our discussion, is that they need to be concerned about this stuff and to start doing the research for themselves, because these people, as we said at the top of the show, they've got Donald Trump's ear. They're in the White House right now. They're holding meetings. And the scary part is, I was reading an article about this, and they're saying that the main problem with the Trump Evangelical Advisory Board, in addition to the obvious, theological issues that they're bringing to the table, is that, first of all, they don't talk about when they're going to hold meetings. So we don't know when they actually meet with Trump. And then secondly, they don't record minutes of those meetings, which is technically illegal. Anytime the president meets with anybody, there should be a record of it. There should be minutes of what they talked about.
Yeah.
Nothing. We don't know what they're talking about. We don't even know when they meet. We don't know who's there. The only reason we know they're there is they talk about it after the meeting is over. And they'll come out and say, oh, we just met with President Trump, and isn't that wonderful? And you're like, wait a minute. What the hell?
Yeah.
You can't do that. But they're doing it, and they're getting away with it. That alone should be a major concern. People like Paula White Cain, she's in the White House. She's now on staff, I guess, for his faith initiative thing. She's the chairman of that.
Yeah.
And she's a complete Dominionist, charismatic, health and wealth gospel, all the rest of it. She's his major spiritual advisor.
Yeah. Oh no, it's something
else. Unbelievable.
And they, of course, since they have an ear to the president, they can affect policy.
Exactly.
And this is why people need to take this seriously, especially in the U.S., because the 2020 election is coming. And if people don't take these individuals seriously, it's going to be a repeat of what happened in 2016. And if he's reelected, it's going to be worse. The next 4 years will be catastrophic, literally. So people need to be, you know, it's good to sound the alarm and make people aware of how these individuals think and how, you know, a lot of the decisions, even if that Trump has made in the past 3-4 years have been profoundly influenced by their worldview that they're sharing. He doesn't understand everything, but he needs their voice. He needs their
vote. That's it. And that I was listening to a podcast about this today that, you know, is Trump little more than a useful idiot? He's got people like Stephen Miller who have a huge white nationalist, white supremacist agenda. He's getting stuff done on the behest of his own agenda. These evangelicals are using Trump, but in a sense, he's turning around to using them. They're being played just as much so it's in their view, it's a win-win
situation. You know?
They're going out providing religious cover for Trump, and yet at the same time, that was what I pointed out. I wrote an article on Medium about that open letter response, and I said, they give away the whole game right here because they're saying the reason we support Trump is he's getting our agenda done.
Yeah.
You know, family values, religious freedom. Yeah. And I'm like, that's the whole point. Why else would they support the guy and continue to provide a cover for him? He's advancing their agenda, which they think is going to become a Christian America again and all this other kind of talking points. Even though that's been completely debunked, which hopefully I'll get into with Andrew Seidel, which is obviously the theme of his book, is this whole myth of a Christian America is a major dominionist talking point. We have to return to that in order to have this covenant status with God and all the rest of it. So, yeah, it's it'll make your head explode.
Yeah, that should be really good.
Well, okay, so we should probably end it here then. I know we could talk for another probably hour or so, but the reason I want to end it is not because I don't want to keep talking to you, but because it'll leave more in the bag for another return visit.
Oh, so yes, why not?
What I'm going to do is I'm going to keep researching. I'm going to keep writing. Obviously, you're doing a ton of work on this as well. As things change, we definitely need to circle around then and come back and
yes.
If you're up for it, I would love to have you back on at a certain, whatever, you know, next few months. I don't know what your schedule is, as things develop, we'll touch back and see where we're at.
For sure.
If that works
again,
for you.
It was, like usual, a pleasure talking with you. I wish you all the best for your podcast this year. You know, next podcast should be very promising.
I'm looking forward to
listening to that. So thank you very much, Clint, for your kind invitation again.
Thank you, Dr. Andre Gagne, once again for not only returning, but for being the inaugural kickoff podcast episode for 2020, talking about this incredibly important topic. If you're not aware of what's going on, especially with what's happening in the Trump White House, that alone should scare you to death. It's really concerning. So hopefully we'll get more into this on a return visit. Stay tuned. The next episode in 2 weeks is coming up with Andrew Seidel of the Freedom From Religion Foundation. That's going to be incredibly important. If you want to follow me on Twitter, you can get a hold of me at MindShift2018 on Twitter. What's your Twitter handle, by the way, Andre, if people want to get a hold of you on Twitter?
It's ProfAGAGNE. So Prof A Gagne, essentially, one word, and very easy to find me on Twitter. And I use Twitter a lot. This is my preferred
social platform.
Yeah, for sure.
So if you want to get a hold of Andre, get a hold of him, follow him on Twitter, follow me on Twitter, do what you can to get the word out there as we're trying to do. So thank you once again, Dr. Andre Gagne. It's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you again. We'll come back around and do this again, hopefully in maybe a few months. I don't know what what we can do, but thank you once again. I will speak to you soon.
All right. Take care.
Take care. Talk to you later.